the second part of the interview with General Hamilton Twitchell took place in Bethesda, Maryland on June 3rd, 1988. General Twitchell, when I met with Richard Arndt a few weeks ago, he mentioned in passing that your survey team to Iran of 1962 included Alexander Haig and Richard Kennedy, who later was Haig's deputy, one of Haig's assistants at the NSC and the State Department in the early 80s. What were their roles on the survey team?
Well, they were both Army members of a team. And
you know how they came to be assigned to the team?
Right. The Army nominated Haig, and as I mentioned, and Ambassador Holmes suggested that I should get Kennedy because he had just returned from a tour in Iran.
Had Kennedy been with Armish Mag in Iran?
Yes.
Oh, I see. Okay. Now, when you were later appointed Armish Mag Chief in 68, how much preparation did you receive? For example, were you given special briefings on Iran before you left for Tehran?
At that time, they used to run a... DOD used to run a course on military assistance. I think it was a 2-week course. Mm-hmm. I attended that course. In addition, I did have briefings for over, say, a period of 2 or 3 days with interested government agencies. Mm-hmm. Primarily bringing me up to date on U.S. policy, developments in the area, any particular thoughts on problems that I might run into.
Do you recall who the briefings were given by?
No.
Now, when you were actually stationed in the country, how much access did you have to the Shah? For example, could you meet with them whenever you chose to, or how did that work out in practice?
Well, when I first went there, I called on the Shah. I had an audience with the Shah. Mm-hmm. Shortly after I arrived, thereafter, I met with him, I'd say, once every 4 or 5 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I think in nearly all occasions, it was based on a time when I felt that I had something that was worth reporting to the Shah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you took the initiative for an appointment. Okay. How free was your access to Iranian military installations?
Basically, when I wanted to take a trip out of Tehran, or when I wanted to visit some of the installations in Tehran,
mm-hmm.
I arranged through my military, Iranian military aid, to make the to work out a program. I don't think I was ever denied access to any of the installations. Probably the one which foreigners visited the least was the Imperial Guard. However, I think I went there 2 or 3 times, and then we gave them some suggestions on matters that were of interest to the commander.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So again, basically, I never felt that I had had any particular problem with visiting the air, navy, or ground installations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You said you had an Iranian military aide. Who was that person?
His name was Mohammad Ghadassi.
Mm-hmm. Was he your aide all the way through?
Yes.
What kind of things did he help you with? He helped make arrangements like the various tours that you mentioned.
He made arrangements with Deputy. Provided some liaison with the SCS staff in terms of people to talk with or members of the mission to talk with. Mm-hmm. And he had a very close relationship with the office of the Chief of Supreme Commander Staff, so that we had a very close contact there. For example, if I wanted to meet with General Arianna or later JAM or JAM's successor, then I would ask Odyssey to contact the SCS Chief's office and set up an appointment.
I see. Okay. Now, when you're Chief of Army Schmeg, how much of Iran did you see? How widely did you travel during the 3 years that you were?
Well, first of all, when I went there in '62, I saw a good deal of the country. I went all along the northern border by jeep. I went down to Abadan. And I saw the Navy, such as it was at that time, down in the upper part of the Gulf, or on the Shatt al-Arab. Mm-hmm. I visited the area installations. I went again in '69 and to '71. I visited all the installations in the northwest, the north, the northeast, on the southern flank, and also on the eastern flank, as well as on the west. So I saw a good deal of the country, by air and by ground.
What were your impressions of economic and maybe social conditions of the country when you were during your second tour?
Well, first, I would say that the first time I saw Iran was in the end of 42 or very early in 43. Mm-hmm. And the change when I went back in 62 was very evident. And then again in 69, there was a tremendous, or 68, there was a tremendous change even between 62 and 68. Mm-hmm. Particularly in 68, while there was still our economic mission there, the country was beginning to develop some of its own civilian industries in particular. The Military Industries Organization was primarily concerned with the production of small arms, batteries, copper wire. And then during my stay there, they moved forward with more advanced and more sophisticated production matter. So I would say that in general the population appeared to be much better off materially than in the past. And from what I have gathered, primarily this continued to increase. Problems arose when the economy overheated. People were led to expect many things in the mid-70s, and they just didn't have the capacity to carry out all their programs.
Okay. I have some more questions on the on arms sales issues that we were talking about when we ended the last meeting. Did you review the contracts that the Shah negotiated with U.S. companies?
Once the Iranian government began to began to negotiate with a firm, we did not participate in any discussion. The only time that I was involved was when I sat in on a discussion between Representative McDonnell Douglas and Tufanian, but I did not have to play any role in that.
You sort of observed.
That is more complicated, but basically the question was whether the Iranians would deal directly with McDonnell Douglas, or whether they would ask the Pentagon to negotiate the contract. And there's a general proposition to finding and preferred to deal through the Pentagon rather than through individual contractors.
I see. Now, how much contact did you have in general with representatives of the U.S. firms that sold weapons to Iran?
As I remembered it, firms coming out to representatives of firms coming to Tehran were supposed to check with the MAG to notice, to let us know that they were there, to discuss what they were. It was not there with our endorsing the program or with our trying to influence it. Mm-hmm. The only thing that I ever tried to do was to explain to whoever was involved with such efforts was to be sure they understood what some of the limitations were on the country to absorb the equipment.
Mm-hmm. Were there any kinds of rules or regulations that you had to follow when you met with these representatives?
I don't think I had anything more specific than one. I was, you know, I was not there to sell arms.
Yeah.
I was there to advise the government.
Who were some of the individuals that would come by Tehran when you were stationed there? Do you recall some of the companies or the names of the representatives? That
well, the aviation companies were particularly active. And when I first got there, the Iranians were considering whether they should retrofit the M-47 tanks with diesels rather than gasoline motors. So at that time, I think I saw the representatives of several different companies who were coming in to make proposals to the Iranian government.
Do you recall any names of some of the individuals that were involved in this, in that particular effort, the retrofitting effort?
Well, a retired general named Ennis was one of those, I think. Mm-hmm. General Motors had a representative there. I just don't recall the names.
Was Kermit Roosevelt an occasional visitor?
I don't think I ever saw Kermit Roosevelt all the time I was in Iran. I saw him when I got back here in connection with the Iran-American Society, but I don't think I ever saw him when he was there. Hmm. Nor did I necessarily hear that he was there.
Okay. Did the representatives of the arms companies often also meet with the chiefs of the services that were at Amish Mag, like the chief of the Army mission or the Air Force mission?
Particularly on the air side, but I would say all three.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To what extent could the service representatives promote the sale of weapon systems that their branch of the service favored back in Washington? Was there any effort on their part to promote sales of certain?
If they did, they never told me about it.
Yeah.
We didn't run into the problem that arose in connection with the F-14, F-15 affair.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If that's what you're kind of,
I guess, yeah.
Leading to.
Yeah, yeah. But they were careful. There was nothing that you knew about in that respect. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Were there any circumstances where you or the service chiefs could give the suppliers assistance in making sales, for example, by helping them with their presentation to the government of Iran? Is there any?
You know, if you did that with one, you had to do it with all.
Yeah, yeah.
And the only time I became involved with anything which might relate to that was in connection with this tank retrofit program. We did suggest to the Iranians that if they were interested in going ahead with it and had some had some questions about the capabilities mm-hmm. of the different companies to produce a retrofit tank, and since there was no way of actually making any judgments, mm-hmm. that they asked the companies to send out a tank and have it tested. But that was, I guess that's the only thing that I would have felt was involved.
Mm-hmm. Okay. During this period, did any of the companies, any of the arms companies, have any trouble with the Iranian government? In the 68 to 71, were there any times when companies had difficulties with the government? And their use of go-betweens or expediters, whatever.
Well, I think, you know, not sure how far back it goes, I think there was always the problem, the concern of agents.
Yeah.
Which became particularly acute in the Grumman affair. I guess just based on general conversation, one would assume that the feeling in the among the foreign firms, when I say foreign, not just relating it to Americans, mm-hmm. was that somehow this was necessary. Basically, Tufanian, that was one of the reasons that Tufanian preferred to deal through the Pentagon, with the idea that that would reduce the possibility. My general feeling is that the arms salespeople, the industrial firms, bore an important responsibility for this climate, because if they had not agreed to pay such fees, that this would have stopped a good deal of it. So that, as I sat there and saw it, I just felt both sides were at fault.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay.
Now you've got to realize that the competition was not just between U.S. firms. It was Italian firms. It was British. There were British firms, French firms.
Mm-hmm. International competition.
Then you have the subsidiaries of U.S. firms. For example, the Italian Augusta Bell. There were incidents, for example. The Italians would push a very light helicopter, which we felt could not take off during the hot summer months in high altitudes. Something like that, when the Iranians asked us for an estimate, for a technical estimate of something, we gave them that technical estimate. Then that was their determination to go ahead. They went ahead with it. Mm-hmm. And later they found that the helicopter was not satisfactorily performed. Another case where, again, a foreign helicopter, presumably an American Bell helicopter designed, equipped, and so on, except assembled in a foreign country, did not have the same component parts in certain instances, and there were problems there. So there were some of those instances where there were problems, but the problems were not of the magnitude that they were in the period of the F-14, F-15 controversy.
No, they had more oil income to use,
yeah.
Greater arms sales being made, greater higher levels of sales being made. Now, during and after 1973, the technical assistance field teams, the so-called TAFs, played a major role in training Iranian military men to use the high-tech weapon systems that the U.S. was selling in the 70s. I read that the idea of the TAFs in Iran had their origins around 69 because of the problems of assimilating the F-4s in the Iranian Air Force. Was that the problem that led to the TAFs, or was it more complicated than that?
The problem that led to the task was that the Congress put a ceiling on the number of people that could be in MAGS. And then the Taft assignment was a manner in which they resolved that particular problem. You still went to get on to the basic point that you had, in other words, you had advisors were there. From the point of view of the individuals who were there as members of the Taft team, some of them felt that they were there in the capacity of being merchants, paid merchants, or soldiers of fortune. And there was a psychological problem, particularly since most of them were there billeted right in the middle of an Iranian NSA Air Force installation, which is where most of the TAF teams were. So I think we would have been then better off to say, you know, if they're part of the MAG per se, and that if you can have advice that, in other words, if you're prepared to sell equipment, you should then be prepared to provide the advisor. My own feeling was that from the point of view of a, I'd say from any recipient government, they should not become too dependent on foreign advisors. And that in, I think it's pretty well known, I generally recommended that, not with the idea of curbing the Iranian purchases, but with the idea that they should not be ordering equipment until you had, at the same time, the country took the steps to have properly trained personnel on hand when the equipment arrived. Now, there can be a short indoctrination period, just like in our own services, when a new, highly sophisticated weapon comes into the inventory. There are times when civilian technicians are there, particularly air and navy and so on, to help make a transition. But when you get to the point where you're having so many technicians, then there are critical problems.
And were the TAFs used with the F-4 program when you were in Iran?
Yeah.
They were not under your supervision, though.
They were generally under the MAG supervision, but they were charged off as a TAF team, and they were so you had this, if you will, bookkeeping procedure. They had all the privileges of the MAG, and also they were under the general supervision in the case of the Air Force of the Air Force section.
How successful was this program in practice? How well did it work out when you were, from your vantage point?
Well, I think from the point of view of providing the technical assistance, they were supposed to be trainers. One of the things that you had to be constantly on the alert for was the tendency of a TAF member or an advisor that he was there to instruct the Iranians and teach them how to become technically proficient. There's a tendency on part of many of the individuals to feel it was easier to do the job themselves. And that was defeating the very purpose of what was intended.
Was the idea of the TAF being used on a wider scale during the course of your stay in Iran? Was it used beyond the F-4 program or?
Well, it was used later.
Yeah, after 1973.
Yeah, because we didn't have anything beyond the F-4s. And I don't think in the case of the helicopters before I left that was the case, but later on it was case. Because I think they did have a number of TAF members in the helicopters. Williamson would know more about that, or possibly others.
Okay. Now, during the 1960s and the following years, the Shah and General Tufanian had plans or programs to build up Iran's military industries. Now, you talked a little bit about this earlier, a few minutes ago. Did Armish Mag play any role in facilitating this development of an autonomous military and industrial sector in Iran?
I'm just trying to think. I don't remember whether we were in terms of processing Iranian requests for technical assistance and so on. Certainly we played a role in the case of the M-47 retrofit. Once the Iranians decided that they wanted to go the retrofit route, we played a role because those tanks, which were provided as Eleanor Grant aid, were basically U.S. property. And so there was a DOD interest in the arrangements that were made in connection with the retrofit.
At our last meeting, you talked a bit about the annual review procedure and the degree to which the annual review constrained the Shah's access to an American's arms market.
That was in terms primarily of the amount of loans which the Ex-Im Bank would agree to. And there's where there was a country team approach to their review of the Iranian economy and the situation and the extent to which to support or comment on the Iranian request.
So this is sort of a limit of the Shah's ability to get credits from the United States. But yes. This was sort of a limitation was eroding as oil revenues increased.
Yes.
But besides this financial limitation, were there any other controls over the Shah's purchases of U.S. weapons? In the late 60s or early 70s?
I think in one or two instances, some of the requests on even certain minor items were denied, just as possibly as a general matter of policy back in Washington of transferring those items. But generally, there weren't any. Again, you got into the problem of the normal procedure was that when equipment first came off the line, it went to the U.S. forces first and to other countries. The Shah always demanded, very frequently demanded, that he receive the most recent equipment, particularly when he began to pay for it. So there was that factor. That was not a country team assessment. That was a DOD assessment. Then it got into the priorities, Europe, whatever particular countries might be involved in the item.
Okay. I have another question that relates to this last one. I've read that under the Johnson administration, there was sort of a perennial debate in Washington over the extent to which the United States should supply the Shah with advanced weapon systems like the F-4, other fighter jets. The State Department generally supported the Shah's requests for military, for advanced weapon systems. And I guess the officials of the Pentagon, and ISA in particular, were generally more critical, more skeptical of the Shah's requests for advanced systems. How familiar were you with those debates when you were in Iran?
I really didn't have first-hand knowledge of the debates themselves. I think the general concern was of those who had the reservation was again the question of ability to absorb. Mm-hmm. And there is a matter of philosophy, I guess. Many times I think states, and I'm not talking just necessarily with Iran, mm-hmm. is inclined to see the political benefits of arms transfer in terms of relationships, and whereas the Pentagon, particularly before the days of when people were purchasing equipment, and then the income from that had some bearing on some of the decisions, at least it appeared to me. Mm-hmm. But that the more critical problem was the extent to which somebody could maintain and handle equipment. Particularly as you got into the more sophisticated equipment, do you have the backup? How are you going to arrange for major overhauls? My own feeling is that as a general proposition, it's important to recognize that the transfer of arms is in general only a temporary benefit.
You mean politically?
Politically. Yeah. That you have a change of regime, as we saw in 79, where you have a problem of it possibly being used against you or being used in ways that you had not agreed to. But secondly, that while you have a compatibility of interest in some respect, in many cases, particularly in terms of the regional aspects, there is not that same basic acceptance of compatibility.
Did you have the sense that the State Department, in terms of the political implications you were talking about a minute ago, did you have the sense that the officials of the state assumed that that arms sales would bring the U.S. foreign influence in a country like Iran or other arms recipients?
Well, let me put it another way. I think they felt that because of the Shah's extreme interest, that it was important in terms of our relationships. Now, with the Nixon regime and the Guam Declaration, it took on all the more importance of where we decided we could no longer be the gendarme around the world and we had to rely on other nations. And so then this was really the genesis of this, coupled with the oil income, uh-huh. was the genesis of that tremendous buildup.
Exactly.
Certainly, as events have shown, you know, it just backfired just because of the change in the internal Iranian political structure.
Now, after when the Nixon administration came in 1969, did the Pentagon's reservations about absorptive capacity, they still continued? This question still.
I think they still had some concerns. I heard General Fish, who was the head of the arms, DSA.
Yeah.
I've heard him say on a number of occasions that they had concerns over certain transfers.
Did you get a sense of where Secretary of Defense Laird stood on these issues?
Except it basically, and I don't think anybody can deny the strategic view that, from the point of view of the United States, that it was desirable to try to develop capabilities of friendly nations in the various regions to provide for the stability of the area. And certainly under Laird, and he had what was called the total force concept, and that was this relations not only between the active and the reserve military in our country, but also the relationship between our forces, those in Europe, Middle East, and so on. And then the twin pillar concept of Iran and Saudi Arabia as being the two most likely candidates in the Gulf.
I was going to ask you about the twin pillars idea. Did you talk to the Shah about this concept, or did he discuss it with you, this idea of Saudi Arabia and Iranian cooperation?
I think I'd say he talked with me on a number of occasions about security of the Gulf, expressed his concern, particularly about in the very early days, about in 68, for example, his concern about Nasser, particularly when he went into Yemen, the fact that he was concerned about the Gulf, security of the Gulf, particularly the Arabs. As far as the Saudis were concerned, I think he felt a certain degree of sameness, if you will, in terms of the conservative Gulf leaders and themselves being among the last heads of state in the area who had some basically the same views regarding their safety. And the Shah did make an effort to reduce the concerns about an expansion of Iran. They were quite convinced the Arab Gulf states of this, but there was that, and particularly in 71 when he took Tunis and Abu Musa and so on. But that again created this fear. On the other hand, when he went in to support Oman and then withdrew his forces, again that, I think, possibly lessened that fear temporarily. I think he looked upon Iran as having, you know, the greatest potential in terms of the number of people, its resources, and so on, of being the principal stabilizing factor in the Gulf. He was also concerned about getting oil out of the Gulf, particularly once he had the oil coming out of the offshore stations and the criticality of Karg. So when the British announced him before then, he was apprehensive about it, but he became more concerned about not only the Gulf itself, but the approaches to the Gulf.
So he didn't quite see it in terms of the Twin Pillars, but in terms of the Saudis playing a somewhat more subordinate role, with Iran playing a primary role? Is that how he thought
that? That would be my estimate. But he was certainly making efforts to deal more effectively with the Saudis.
Did he discuss that effort with you, or what he was trying to do in practical terms?
From time to time, he discussed particular measures that he thought, incidents which he was coordinating, supporting.
Do you recall anything in particular, or?
Well, he was particularly concerned when the situation in the Yemen, about the threat that posed to Saudi Arabia.
Was he taking any steps to deal with that situation, or was it more just a question of discussion at that point?
Well, first of all, the MAG was not there to get in discussion with operational matters with them. So we had to be very careful not to get involved in something that they were dealing with the other countries about, and they, generally they didn't tell us, and I'm not sure whether the other agencies or telling agencies picked up things or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to get one back to this question of Laird. Did he ever visit Iran when you were there, Melvin Laird?
No.
Did any other senior Defense Department officials come through?
When you say senior...
Or like his deputy or one of the assistant secretaries for ISA or...
No, the head of the Middle East section came out. Jim Noyes came out from... He's out in California now.
Mm-hmm. He met with you then.
And there was, I'll think of the man's name. I think I wrote it down here. Bob Pringer from, who was in the office at that time in ISA. They were the two seniors that came out in OSD. Also the chairman of the Joint Chiefs came out in connection with the CENTO meeting.
Who was that at that time? That was,
Wheeler.
Wheeler, that's right. And you met with them on during their visits?
I went with Wheeler to when he called on the Shah, and then I saw it socially.
Mm-hmm. They came to discuss. He came to discuss CENTO matters with the Shah. Or?
He came. The CENTO military committee was meeting in Tehran, mm-hmm. so he attended that session.
Mm-hmm. Did you have anything to do with CENTO when you were there? Did you have any role regarding CENTO issues when you were? With Army Schmack?
Not very little. I saw the American representatives to the CENTO staff, the permanent representative, when he came to Tehran, particularly in connection with CENTO affairs. And from time to time there were questions that came up involving the U.S. role in CENTO and in Iran, but generally CENTO channels were different. Westmoreland came out after he became chief of staff on a visit.
You met with the Shah as well?
I think he did, but I'm not sure. Generally, whenever the commander of Sink Strike came out, he met with the Shah.
Who was that at that time?
Well, Throckmorton was one of them, and
Throckmorton.
Well, I gave you Throckmorton.
Okay. Yeah.
And then the one that I'll think of his name, Ted. I'll think of him a little bit. Conway.
Conway. You mentioned earlier that in terms of the chain of command, you reported to Sinstrike, Commander Sinstrike?
Through the JCS channel, for those things which the chiefs were responsible for, I reported through Sinstrike. Some of the things in connection with military assistance programs, particularly the implementation of them, so on, I dealt through OSD. There were times when there would be a State Defense telegram which I would contribute to, which the embassy sent into the State and Defense. And so you just determined which particular headquarters you dealt with based on the subject.
Now, Sinstrike, what does that stand for?
Imagine Chief Strike Command.
And that, what was that command?
It was a joint command to deal with situations other than Europe. Primarily.
So it would include the Middle East, but other areas as well?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'll turn this over.